This episode of China Money Podcast is sponsored by Lehman Brown, a China accounting, audit, and advisory firm. Golden Gate, a law firm providing a full range of legal services in China. Covert Limited, a leading internet privacy tool. And 51mice.com, a comprehensive online platform for meetings, incentives, conferences, and exhibitions in China. Please go to our website, chinamoneynetwork.com, and click on our sponsors' links. Thank you so much, everyone, for your support. Hi, everyone. Welcome to China Money Podcast. I'm your host, Nina Xiang. Our guest today is Dorit Lackey, chairman of Sterling Finance, a research and consulting firm based in Hong Kong and focused on China's pension and asset investment industry. Mr. Lackey spoke with me earlier this week in Hong Kong. He shared his views on how China's provincial pension funds should diversify their investments and also the possibility of China establishing more national-level funds to manage its pension assets. Here is our conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Stuart. Welcome.
Good morning, Nina.
So it's interesting how we met. We met at event at the Hong Kong Asia Society Center, one of the exhibitions.
Yes, a few weeks ago. Yes.
Right, and then I think I ran into you in a few different other conferences, and you have so many other people who know you and pass by and say hi to you. So you have been in Hong Kong for a long time and have been doing research on the fund investment industry in China.
Yes.
So you know all about the industry.
Yes.
That's why today we're going to talk about the fund investment industry, but from a GP LP perspective, as our audience are mostly people who work in the alternative investment industry in China.
Mm-hmm.
So let's first start by looking at the LP landscape in China.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, what is the composition of the limited partners landscape in China?
Perhaps let me just step back from that before we get into the detail. As you mentioned, I've been in Hong Kong a long time, so know Hong Kong extremely well. Over about the last 15 years, I've become increasingly involved with China, and over that period of time, there's been many, many developments, including, of course, you know, private equity and so on. My particular focus is to look at pension funds and pension assets, pension investments, and I've done many projects for the central government on reforming and restructuring the pension system. Now, of course, once you start to make promises about pensions, then you've got to think about how's it going to be paid for, you know, how's the money going to be invested, you know, what's going to happen. So that's how, if you like, the interest in LPs and so on bumps up against my own particular activities. So with the domestic market, it's really quite difficult to get accurate figures as to what's happening here. But it's definitely big, it's definitely very active. If anything, there's perhaps been too much money chasing after too few good opportunities in the last year or two. So obviously this is something that will go in cycles. Either there's too much money chasing not enough opportunities, or there's not enough money and lots of opportunities. So, I mean, the skill is you know, to know where you are in the cycle, and then the cycles, of course, may not be synchronous depending on the different types of activity. I mean, there's obviously a lot of attention being paid to high tech, but then healthcare is also very vibrant in China. And then even very basic things like baby food and trying to get that up to a decent standard. So there's so many things happening in China that, I mean, the difficulty is always China's so big. So where do you start? Where do you prioritize?
So it's interesting you mentioned pension, so let's focus on pension, because if you are a private equity fund trying to raise money in the US or Europe, pension funds will be a big chunk of the limited partners who you're going to talk to.
Yes.
But in China, when you talk about pension, especially pension assets that could be invested into alternative investments, that's very limited. There's only a few of them. So.
Well, just to mention for a moment the structure of the pension landscape in China. First of all, we have to differentiate between people with urban residency cards and with rural residency cards. And the rural side is very tiny, very kind of backward in terms of pension provision. But the urban system is becoming more sophisticated. Now, part of it is unfunded, so it's pay-as-you-go, and the other part of it is funded, but it's very conservatively funded, typically in government bonds and cash deposits. And they're only now starting to put a little bit into equities.
And their returns have been terrible.
The returns have been very, like, very, very weak.
Below interest, or below inflation and below growth.
Certainly, well, in pensions, we always look at price inflation, we look at salary inflation. So the returns may have been equal or ahead a little bit of price inflation, but they've been way behind from salary inflation because, of course, salaries and earnings have gone up very rapidly in China in the last 10, 20 years. So,
and that's all because of the investment strategy, very conservative. They can only put money into government bonds.
Yes.
And the government realized that they want to change it.
Government do want to change it. And in fact, there was a number of announcements made 2 or 3 months ago during the time of crisis in the Chinese stock market. So the government are now saying that they're going to permit some of the provincial pension money to be invested in equities. So
that's very good timing, right?
It is good timing.
Price.
I mean, people will say, oh, the market has just gone down, you know, 50%. This is the worst time. In fact, this is the best time. Because the whole point about pensions is it should be very long term. And almost always there's new money coming in every month. So you don't particularly want high prices. What you want is you know, situations that are good value and will realise lots of potential increase
I guess the problem is in terms of perception. So the public might perceive that, you know, the pension money, i.e. the government money, could be used to save the market, which is not.
Well, I mean,
you want people to get.
Yes, I would argue strongly that irrespective of the condition of the stock market, the pension fund the provincial pension fund should be allowed to invest some of their money in equities. But this decision that the government made, it was probably a good decision, but not made for good reasons. I mean, it was really made to try and bail out the stock market. It wasn't made from the much more fundamental reason of getting pensioners and prospective pensioners in China exposed to hopefully long-term gains from the equity market.
So if we look at the pension money in China, we have the National Social Security Fund, which is a last resort fund that could come in whenever other pension funds fell short.
Yes.
And then we don't really have a corporate pension system. We have an enterprise annuity. Like, can you explain a little bit for rural residents? I guess they're so small we can ignore them.
Yes, we'll set aside the rural situation because that's a problem of a different scale. So if we look at urban employees, I mean, all urban employees, whether they're employed by a state-owned enterprise, collectively owned enterprise, you know, private sector, joint venture, foreign company, what they should do is they should pay contributions of 8% of salary every month up to a ceiling, and employers are paying about 20%, so very high contribution rates. And this is really to pay for the legacy pensions from the old state-owned enterprise days, where employees in state-owned enterprises got very generous pension provision. So China's trying to contain or cut back that state benefit. So after the state benefits, you do have the enterprise annuities, as you just mentioned, Nina. Now, that is like it's a slightly clumsy phrase in English to talk about enterprise annuities, but it means enterprise in the sense of corporation or employer or sponsor. An annuity just is short for a pension plan. So, in fact, the enterprise annuities are indeed corporate pension plans. They can actually invest up to 30% in equities. So they've got much more flexible investment parameters than the state benefits have.
How are the money under enterprise annuity pooled?
By
company or?
Yes, it's normally a company that will decide that, maybe it's a company that has got a lot of highly paid people, or maybe it's very profitable industry. So it's a matter of decision for each company as to whether they do establish an enterprise annuity plan or not. So first of all, you can only establish an enterprise annuity plan if you're up to date with your contributions for Social Security. In other words, the government won't let you not pay Social Security in order to pay for enterprise annuities. The enterprise annuities has been growing reasonably rapidly, or maybe not as rapidly as it should grow by Chinese standards. There's a bit over 20 million people at the moment have got enterprise annuity plans. But, I mean, that's out of, you know, the 1.4 billion total population, or the whatever it is, about 900 million workforce. So,
and it's also a huge burden for the company itself.
Well,
20%.
Companies, if they set up enterprise annuity plans, they're usually relatively modest plans. It's typically, you know, 4 or 5% from the company, and maybe even less from the employer. So, I mean, it may be sort of from the employee, it may be 2 or 3% from the employee and 4 or 5% from the employer. So obviously that provides extra benefits, which can be paid in a lump sum or can be paid as a monthly pension after retirement. So it helps to top up the state benefits, but it's not huge. Now, just coming on to the National Social Security Fund, this is a very, very interesting fund indeed. It was set up in October 2000, and it was set up very quietly by two ministries jointly, Ministry of Finance and Ministry of Human Resource and Social Security. So, as you indicated, this National Social Security Fund, it was set up to, there was various statements made, to help China in its time of need, to assist the provinces if they didn't have the financial ability to meet all the pension payments, and it was also to guard against aging population in China. So this fund has started off pretty small, but it's now about 250 billion US dollars, so it's pretty significant. And it's now generally classified as more of a sovereign wealth fund than a real pension fund. In order for a fund to be a pension fund, then you should know who are the members, who are the beneficiaries. But with the National Social Security Fund, we don't know who the members are, we don't know who the beneficiaries are, we don't really know how this money is going to be used. So all of these things make it more like a sovereign wealth fund than a real pension fund.
Where did the money come from?
Well, the money comes from several sources. In the early years after, you know, year 2000, for about 2 or 3 years after that, subventions were granted by Ministry of Finance to go into the fund. And then during the year, the decade or 15 years from 2000 up until now, a lot of the IPOs in China, particularly the foreign IPOs, but also domestic IPOs, had to pay either 10% or 5% of the IPO proceeds into the National Social Security Fund. And sometimes, I mean, it makes me wonder, because if you take, you know, one of the IPOs in the last several years...
You mean IPO of state-owned companies?
Yes, IPOs of state-owned companies.
Whether it's international or domestic.
Yes. Okay. For example, an IPO that was hugely popular in Hong Kong was China Life. When it went public, I mean, there were several hundred thousand people in Hong Kong applied for shares. And I don't think they realized, without reading the small print, that 10% of all their money was going to the National Social Security Fund. So all the 10% of all the money collected in the IPO went to the NSSF.
Well, it's good for the...
It's good for the NSSF.
It's good for the people who ultimately benefit from...
Well, I mean, once we know, whether this is in 10 years' time or 50 years' time or when this is going to happen, sometimes I'm asked to comment on the diversification. The NSSF is quite widely diversified. I mean, it's got international equities, it's got alternative investments, including private equity and hedge funds and so on. So... If I'm asked about the level of diversification, you know, is that diversification not very good? My answer is, I put on my actuary hat, and what I say is that if you tell me exactly the nature and duration of liabilities, I will tell you whether the diversification is good. But we don't know the nature and duration of the liabilities. All we know is there's this pot of money, and they're trying to make it grow, sometimes with money from Ministry of Finance, sometimes from IPOs, sometimes from investment earnings. Also, a number of provinces, when they run the provincial license, the lottery license fee goes into NSSF, just another source of revenue that the government has decided on.
So if we look at the portfolio of the National Social Security Fund, they don't really tell you alternatives. They don't really separate into alternatives.
Yeah, well, they do actually publish an annual report, which is gradually getting better. It's gradually becoming more informative. They put a 20% limit on foreign investments, but in fact, the last figures I looked at, it was somewhere closer to 10%.
8.5% in international assets.
And what's the date of that?
2014.
Oh, 2014, okay. Yeah, so end of last year.
Yes.
So 8.5% in 2014. Okay, well, that's, I guess, just under the 10% that I mentioned. If we think about alternative investments as a whole, obviously there's private equity, there's hedge funds, there's property, there's commodities, there's agricultural land, there's all sorts of non-conventional investments. So the key thing is, do the people looking after this, do they have the expertise really to understand what is being invested in? And obviously provincial pension funds, I mean, they are just absolutely not. Government servants in the provinces, they have zero capacity to invest in equities or invest in private equity or anything like this, because they've never ever done this. They've got no training, they've got no real understanding. NSSF is different because it's recruited people, returning turtles, coming back to China, people with 5 and 10 years experience, 15 years experience in Hong Kong, New York, London. So NSSF has built up a very significant force of competent professionals who know about all the different types of investment.
And they're only specifically responsible for looking at alternatives, or they're looking at everything, equity and funds?
Well, they probably look at everything. I know many hedge fund managers and private equity people have given lectures and seminars and tutorials and so on to the NSSF staff in Beijing, and the NSSF welcome this because they want to know what's going on in the wider world. They want to learn, they want to understand. And now, of course, we've got the even bigger sovereign wealth fund, the CIC, and that was actually populated with a couple of the senior people from NSSF, Gao Xicheng and Li Keping. So, in a way, you've got SAFE, State Administration of Foreign Exchange, plus CIC, plus NSSF, and the three of them are all really sovereign wealth funds with slightly different backgrounds, slightly different focus. But I mean, this has obviously got to be a good thing for China Inc. going forward to have this amount of money, savings.
For a rainy day, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, CIC or NSSF are safe. I mean, they should have specific objectives. They should have statement of investment policies. They should decide on asset allocation, broad parameters. They should come up with benchmarks for different types of investment and so on.
Is that what you imagine they already have in place?
Well, yes. In fact, I mean, what was absolutely dramatic was, let me get the year right here, after NSS had been going for a few years, but nobody paid much attention, there wasn't that much money in it. Might have been 2005, need to check on that. And I think it was the day before Christmas, they sent out a request for proposals to international community, only in Chinese, and the day before Christmas, so that the international firms who were got on holiday or who were fast asleep missed this, but the people who were alert and picked up on it. And this actually amazed the world, because what they said was, they spelt out the mandate that we're going to look at, let's say US equities, Far Eastern equities and so on. They spelt out, they wanted to know what the fees would be and their interest in performance fees. They spelt out the benchmark, they spelt out the tracking error. And at that stage, we had no idea that anybody in China knew what a tracking error was. So this was quite
relevant. So it shows some of the perhaps not enough knowledge about the cultural things, but on the professional investment side, they are up to date about...
Yes. Okay. And so they went through a pretty detailed process selecting managers. There was fund managers up and down in every Dragonair flight to Beijing, practically, to find out what was going on and how much. So, in fact, after several months, they did actually finally announce there was about eight winners, eight global investment managers were given mandates for international equities, different types of international equities. So they didn't tell us the fees, they didn't tell us how much money was awarded to each one. I mean, probably maybe a few hundred million US dollars. And if anything, they seemed to go for big names rather than, I mean, there were smaller managers who had good performance.
Safe bets.
Well, yes.
Oh, well, if you think bigger means
safe,
yes.
Yeah, at this stage in the proceedings, it's quite understandable for them to perhaps have some leaning towards big international names rather than boutiques who might have an even better record.
Right, and also if you bet on the names that everybody else is, then you don't, if
you're
it goes
not so
wrong,
isolated.
Get blamed for that.
Exactly.
So if we look at the NSSF's 2014 return, it's pretty good. It's 11.69% for the annual internal rate of return.
That's a pretty good return.
How trustworthy do you think the number is?
Ah, well, now this is another subject. The Chartered Financial Analyst Institute, the CFA Institute, actually has a standard called GIPS, Global Investment Performance Standard. And that sets out exactly how you should calculate performance, you know, allowing for money in, money out on the exact day, and so on. So that is the proper professional standard. Now, sometimes in emerging markets in general, sometimes people kind of cut corners, and particularly with bonds, they may value a bond at the launch price, they may value a bond at the redemption price, they may value it at the amortized price or market value. So particularly with bonds, a lot of people choose how to value them. Now, in the long run, how you value them is not going to determine what real return you get on it. But, I mean, people in China and people worldwide should really be following the GIPS standard, and then we know that we're comparing apples with apples. But the 11% return for 2014 for NSSF, that's pretty good, because the A-share market, of course, did well in 2014. Because
but
this was
but
during
they're not
the
following that standard, right?
Well, they are investing in A-shares, yes.
No, but I mean, for the number,
I hope they're adopting GIPS standards.
But all the public documents, does it say?
I don't think it actually says. So, I mean, that's where, the annual report of NSSF could be further improved. I mean, they should absolutely say what standard they're using to calculate performance. And, I mean, my recommendation would absolutely be to use the GIPS standard.
Does the CIC use the standard, GIPS standard?
I hope so.
But we're not sure.
We need to just study the CIC report and see what it says, but I mean it should spell it out, and I mean it is just the proper way to do things.
Okay.
I mean there is an organization called the Sovereign Wealth Fund Institute, and they had a big conference last April in Korea where I was speaking, and I mean that was one of the topics that people, you know, commentators and people from around the world just have to be in agreement on. I mean, we must, I mean, you don't choose your own scale for temperature. The weather forecast says whatever it is.
So it looks like if you are a private equity fund manager or a hedge fund manager, unless you're the big global players, it's kind of difficult to get into the door with National Social Security Fund.
That's correct, and it's correct for two reasons. I mean, obviously, NSSF and CIC and SAFE, I mean, these are huge monster funds, and they can't make investments with, you know, 5 million here, 10 million there. Their minimum investment has got to be perhaps a few hundred million dollars. So, I mean, you can't have CIC, you know, putting $500 million into a fund that's only got $50 million. So there's that comparative size understanding. And then there's the whole business of having familiarity with names and funds that have been around a long time, KKR, like TPG, Lexington, many, many big funds. So, I mean, it's quite understandable that they should go for larger, well-established firms. But, I mean, gradually, you know, as time goes on, then I mean, some people think it should be possible for smaller funds to get even better returns than larger funds. At some stage, they should be sufficiently confident to start to put a little bit of experimental money into slightly smaller or more specialised PE firms.
What about in terms of direct investments or co-investments? These are a new trend among some of the big LPs. Yeah. You think that's probably a long way off for the Chinese big?
No, I don't think it's a long way off. I think this is already happening. In other words,
we see some direct investments with CIC. They have been doing a few.
Yes, but on the question of fees, my understanding is that the Chinese funds bargain pretty hard on the fees. And sometimes what they want to do, or what they may be trying to do, is they'll put a kind of minimum amount into the main fund, and then they'll become a co-investor without spending any money in fees.
Oh, I see. So who's pursuing them? Probably CIC?
Perhaps.
So they're very focused on trying to minimise the fee.
Well, they're trying to get all the value out of the PE situation and trying to minimise fees. Sure.
Oh.
And I think, I mean, quite frankly, I think many Western firms have been so enamoured that they've fallen in love with China that they agree to this.
Now let's talk about the provincial pension funds. Can you give us a little bit background on...
Yes.
What are there for the provincial pension funds and how are their money managed?
Okay. Well, the state system for the provinces, and this is, of course, the urban employees, there's two parts to it, so have to listen carefully here. The first part is where the employer pays his 20% contributions, and the benefit is a defined benefit that the employee gets when he gets to retirement age. In other words, it's a function of his salary and the number of years he's been contributing. And this is not funded. In other words, the 20% the employers are paying each month is just basically meant to be more or less enough to pay out all the existing pensions to existing pensioners. Second part of the state system, the employees are paying 8% of salary up to a limit, and it's what's called defined contribution, so it's just accumulated up with some interest earnings, and then when you get to retirement age, it's converted to a pension. So every urban employee in the provinces should get part of his pension from the first bit and part of his pension from the second bit. Altogether, for somebody who has a full working career and makes all the contributions, the expectation of the pension is that it should be somewhere about 50% of average working wage. It's higher if you work for state-owned enterprise, or obviously if you're a professional, if you're a teacher or a doctor or something like that, then you would typically get a pension of 4,000 to 5,000 renminbi in a tier one, tier two city. For the average worker, and it's difficult to quote averages, the average worker in China is maybe getting a pension of about 2,000 renminbi. So this is enough to live on, but it's not enough to get rich on.
What about, like, how are those money managed?
Okay, now this is where it gets interesting. See, the first bit, which is pay-as-you-go, there's no real build-up of investments because the money that was collected last month is paid out in pensions next month. So there's maybe just a little bit of money in the pipeline, no time to do anything with it, no time to invest it. But with the bit that the employees are paying their 8%, that is absolutely meant to be funded. But up until now, the restrictions have been only in government bonds, and only in cash deposits. But we've now got this new ruling that hopefully sometime in 2016, the provinces will be allowed to put in a small amount, 3%, 5%, no more than 10%, into domestic equities. We're not talking here about international investments, definitely domestic equities. And that, I think, would be a very good thing. Now, what I've tried to recommend, because of the lack of knowledge and understanding at the provincial level, there's a couple of thoughts here. First of all, I would say that they shouldn't be allowed to just buy and sell any old equity. What the provinces should do with their build-up of assets is put the small amount, 5 or 10%, into exchange-traded funds, into ETFs, because then you're getting broad coverage
just
of the whole...
Tracking the market index.
You're tracking the market. And you don't buy and you don't sell and the fees are pretty low. So, I mean, the last thing we can have is provincial people thinking they know the market and, you know, buying in when the market's high and selling out when the market's low. So, I mean, I would strongly advise... I was very involved with the Tracker Fund in Hong Kong about 15 years ago. And the Tracker Fund, I mean, whether it's whatever index you're tracking, whether it's the CSI 300, whether it's a Shanghai index or a Shenzhen index, or exactly what the index is of secondary importance, as long as it's kind of mainstream index. I mean, take the CSI 300, that's 180 stocks in Shanghai, 120 stocks in Shenzhen. I mean, that's very, very good.
Well, that's obviously the right thing to do, but how likely you think it will be accepted? Because for the provincial people, if they learn, there's nothing they need to do and nothing, you know, offer potential opportunity for them to enrich themselves or their friends, then it's probably not the good option for them and not the option they will end up choosing.
Well, this is where central government would have to, you know, monitor, educate, communicate, you know, draw the line, et cetera, and make sure that everybody's doing things properly. But the other thing that is starting to happen, going back about 4 or 5 years ago, because of the very low returns on the provincial pension investments and because of the rather better returns on NSSF, because NSSF over the last 15 years now has averaged about between 8 and 9% per annum, which is a whole lot better than the 2% per annum that the provincial pension money has averaged. So going back to, I think it was 4 years ago, Guangdong, which is the province with the biggest amount of pension money, it was persuaded to put 100 billion renminbi into the NSSF to be managed. Now, that is clear because there was public announcements to that. What we don't really know was this just... NSSF acting as a manager of this 100 million, or was this 100 billion sort of co-mingled with all of NSSF's other investments, in which case there was some indirect exposure to private equity, to hedge funds, to international investments and so on? Or was this just, how was this managed?
You know, is it like a separate account, or is it like
exactly? Exactly. And it's never been made entirely clear, but The returns, as we would expect, have been a whole lot better, the money that Guangdong's had managed with NSSF than the money they were managing themselves, you know, restricted to government bonds and bank deposits. So now Shandong has been persuaded to do the same thing, because that's another big province with a lot of pension money. And there's about another 10 or dozen provinces that are sort of being lined up.
Now, so what happens eventually? Maybe more of the provincial pension money will be all under the NSSF.
Well, this is where it gets very interesting. The urban pension system that all the provinces have to follow is based on something called Document 26, which State Council issued in 1997. And that basically places responsibility for pensions and pension payments, the money, with provinces, not with national government. And I think there's very good reasons for that. You know, to do it nationally would be too big, and quite frankly, I think Beijing wanted responsibility to be delegated down the line. if we took what's happening to its ultimate limit, where not just Guangdong, not just Shandong, but every province was giving all the money to China, to NSS, not to China, as you say, to centralised China, to the NSSF to manage, that would be such a monster. I mean, who is going to keep an eye on that? How are we going to make sure the money isn't used for all sorts of weird and wonderful purposes? So there has been some talk already about setting up NSSF too.
So that would be specially designed for the provincial pension money?
Perhaps. Good thinking. Why not? And of course, you see, when we were talking about sovereign wealth funds a moment ago, we were saying that it's very interesting to see the similarities and to see the differences between CIC, NSSF and SAFE. So if you had NSSF 2 or whatever it's going to be called, and maybe you need an NSF 3 and NSSF 4. So we've got to get competition between these people. They can't all be doing exactly the same thing, because this really would be the £60,000 gorilla if it was in charge of all of the pension money in China. So how this is going to unfold, we don't know. I hope it's being taken very seriously.
But your suggestion is to start NSSF 2 or 3 or 4.
I think I would try to do both things. I would probably my main priority would be to get the provincial, each province to put some money into ETFs. That to my mind, and let them, you know, send them on courses, you know, deal with the fund managers, be very careful of the brokers because they're out to look after themselves. So that to my mind is that's what I would do first.
How much percentage do you think would be proper?
Year one, 5%, tiny. Year two, 10%, and build it up. At some stage, they should be allowed to invest outside China in ETFs, in a Hong Kong tracker ETF, in a S&P tracker in New York, where once again they will be buying into the market, low fees and no specific specific company risk.
Well, I mean, that just goes back to the eternal debate of whether alternative investments really offer, you know, better returns comparing to just market returns.
But you see, I mean, we can't let the provinces go into alternative investments until people are properly trained. That'll take a generation. I mean, the well-meaning civil servants in Guizhou province, they know nothing about stock markets and
I think you're definitely right.
GPLPs,
yeah,
and
right,
so on.
Nice. So, okay, that's your one of your recommendations is for part of the money to be in ETF funds. And what about the other? You said you have two suggestions, recommendations?
Well, you see, it'd be very tempting to go into infrastructure, to go into commodities, to go into metals and so on. But in order to do that, you need expertise. Now, there's almost no pension plan in Hong Kong that invests in alternatives because they haven't got the expertise. And now, if you take CalPERS in the States or the Norwegian Fund or GPIF in Japan, these are huge funds where they've got a very significant staff and they can hire specialists in property, in real estate, in commodities. They can hire specialists who will watch, even if they're not managing the money themselves, but an external party is watching it. Then watch these guys like a hawk. You know, check the performance. Don't just listen to what they say.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Stuart.